still talking.
Call the House State Affairs Committee meeting in order. Today is April 8th, 1991. The time is 8:09. It's close. Shall we have a quorum? Representatives Moyer, Shelquette, Baker, Miller, and Covina. Today's schedule will be hearing House Bill 225 relating to retirement credit for unused sick leave. House Bill 167 relating to absentee voting. House Bill 138 relating to appropriation for the Clean Water Fund waste management loans. And HCR 12 relating to the Susitna Basin Recreation River Management Plan. And requesting the Commissioner of Natural Resources to reconsider the portion of the management plan that restrict motorized uses on Lake Creek, Alexander Creek, Toto Creek, Deshka, Moose Creek, Deshka, and Tallahoe River. Why don't we start with 225 and then we'll go to your. So, Representative Copeland, would you like to join us, please? Take up 225 by Representative Copeland, allowing retirement credit for unused sick leave for employees at FERS. 225 carries two fiscal notes, one from the Division of Retirement Benefits, the other one from the Finance Division and Department of Administration. Additional costs associated with 225 will be absorbed by all agencies and government subdivisions, making employee contribution PERS like that. Nebel to join us. Nebel, we did have a short hearing on this on Friday. We heard from a number of, obviously, people there at the end. We didn't have a whole lot of time to hear from them, but I was impressed with the way they could keep their testimony brief and short to the point. Representative Copeland, you didn't get a chance to really give us an overview.
For the record, my name is Daniel Copeland from District 21. Essentially, this came to my attention when I was a school principal and found that my teachers were getting the opportunity to add their unused sick leave to their retirement, and yet my custodial staff and secretarial staff and nursing staff at that time were unable to do so. Later, when the nursing staff became teaching staff, that was possible. That status has changed over the years. I was quite aware that my father, who was had been a federal employee, was able to do the same thing. And in fact, there were state employees who transferred over from federal service who had the same opportunity at the time of statehood, shortly after statehood, when we took over the Bureau of Public Roads and made it our Department of Highways at that time. So there's a very scattered situation. Most state employees are covered by contracts that make different kind of arrangements in regard to that. Division of Retirement Benefits, for itself, for example, allows personal leave, which is adaptable for either vacation, sick leave, whatever. So this, however, is not possible for educational staff, who are the principal people who are affected by this. And from the viewpoint of management, I think that, as was argued cogently on Friday, it saves management time and effort, the necessity of replacing someone, and also make sure that the staff don't feel under pressure to use up or their sick leave or to lose it. When I worked for the mining company, I remember the attacks of flu that suddenly struck on the opening day of the hunting season at Fairfax. And I think that we can, should remove that disincentive to show up on opening day. Might allow them some incentive to show up. Most employees do, but I can think of a few who didn't. And it will be a cost to school districts and to universities, but not an actuarially severe one, and it will be spaced over time.
Representative Copeland, can you explain to me a little more how this will work with, are there not some employees in PERS that they have only one type of leave? They're all bunched together. That's sick leave, annual leave, personal leave, everything together.
are not educational staff employees. Those are employees of various departments in the state government where that has been negotiated according to law.
But none of the school districts have that?
No, the school districts, in fact, teachers have this by law.
Right.
And what we're attempting to do is to make it uniform throughout the school district. The other state employees, state employees generally are covered by negotiated contracts, and those contracts can be negotiated to provide other variable kinds of leave.
Do you know what's the real hang-up? Why this bill seems very logical to me. Something that the teachers had. Why have you had to introduce this for a number of years and not have it gone in?
Well, you have to remember that educational staff, classified employees, were not even recognized for the purposes of collective bargaining, that they were sort of non-existent in law for a long time. They sort of slipped out between the time that education employees were removed from the public employees bargaining law. And when the teachers were put into bargaining law, it was specifically teachers. So they were removed, but were not put in under the teachers law. So that's why they, and that was a convenient sort of place. It did mean that it was quite possible for educational staff, all different kinds of treatment. In some areas, there was a fairly good relationship, and in other areas, there was recognition and bargaining for conditions of work, but not on leave policy. Because it means a difference in the whole retirement package, and that should be uniform across all school districts. The other was that in some areas, some of the towns, job like that are used like at Tammany Hall as rewards or punishments depending on who was in with what particular local political mission. There's a broad gamut across school districts.
Questions from committee? All right, Neil, why don't you just slide over here? Is there anyone from the department here? They had someone here on Friday, and I know they closed it somewhat. No? I have got numerous letters of support to this bill.
Incidentally, in looking at it, we found the majority of states have this, as well as the federal government, so that we're essentially unique and not the only state, but we're in the minority. Senate Bill 225, which covers another aspect of the problem, passed the committee on April 5th, which was on Friday.
Do I have anyone else to speak on 225 in the audience? Of course, the administration says in their zero fiscal note, this bill is estimated to cost the state of Alaska $1,314,000 in increased personnel services fiscal year 93, in each year thereafter. Also increased personal service costs to political subdivisions by $886,000 in 93 in each year after. But they give it a zero fiscal note, I assume, because if they're passing the bill, if the bill passes, they expect everyone to absorb the costs. They were here. I don't understand why they say this. rate will increase so much when we're really only talking about, we're not talking about the state employees.
Well, Prince.
Yes. Apparently, there are some classes of state employees who would fit the university system. I really don't know who would affect them. They've never been able to tell me exactly who else besides the education staff employees.
Well, the department not being here to help us.
That sounds like a finance committee question.
I like the bill, Michelle. Which of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we send from committee House Bill 225 with individual recommendations after unanimous consent.
Any objections? Hearing no objections, House Bill 225 is passed in committee with individual recommendations. Thank you, Representative. Are we done, sir? Have we come to anything on our animal bill?
I haven't talked to the subcommittee recently. I've been rather busy with the budget related methods.
Well, that bill, if you still want that bill to move, and we can get together here shortly and try to figure out a way to do so.
There was an article in the paper in the last couple days, the Times, about
that is animal?
Some ponies up in Teller that were mistreated. And there was a comment by one of the rescuers about the bill.
I didn't see that. The next bill the committee will take up is House Bill 138 by Representative Boyer. House Bill 138 will offer a special appropriation of $6.4 million to provide funding for the Solid Waste Recycling Pollution Prevention Program in Alaska. Representative Boyer is joined at the table. Representative Boyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mark Boyer, represent District 20, downtown Fairbanks. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on HB 138. For the information of the members of the committee, last year the legislature introduced and enacted a number of bills that we kind of commonly refer to as the WRAP Act. That was the Waste Reduction, Recycling, and Planning Act, a package of four pieces of legislation. Among them, one essentially established or broadened the state's Clean Water Fund to include solid waste facilities in that bill. A number of other things were also passed, and this year we introduced a similar package to go kind of the next step and begin to continue to focus our attention on controlling pollution and also beginning to get at the problem of begin to manage pollution before it's created in the state of Alaska. The bill before you, when we introduced it 2 months ago, was intended to try to make sure that a lot of little bits and pieces of our recycling and pollution control effort were represented at the table, so to speak, at the Finance Committee level. Since that time, a number of these pieces that are in the bill have been taken care of in the budget bill that the House of Representatives has passed. And actually, with two exceptions, the $150,000 for the solid waste characterization and recycling study, that's a marketing study, and also the $240,000 for hardware and software within the Department of Administration data centers. With those two exceptions, everything else has been taken care of either totally or in part in the operating budget that the House of Representatives sent to the Senate. The $5.5 million for loans for solid waste management facilities was capitalized at the $1.5 million level in the loans budget, and the $300,000 for community solid waste planning grants is a continuing base item within the DEC budget. The $50,000 for hazardous waste reduction grants likewise was an increment that was taken care of in the budget, and the $50,000 for the Pacific Northwest Pollution Prevention Center was also included as an increment to the budget. So again, with the exception of those two other items, the rest has been taken care of in large part in the budget. And what I would propose, Mr. Chairman, without taking additional time in the committee, would be to suggest that a CS, if the committee is interested, a CS could be crafted that would drop the $240,000 for the hardware and software to the Department of Administration. In speaking with several people, we think that that's probably more appropriate in the capital and the governor's capital.
You mean $420,000?
The $240,000.
Section 6?
Yes.
That's $420,000.
That amount of money
is not needed any longer.
That's correct, yes.
Section 6, you would recommend withdraw?
Right, and that you would send a bill, a CS, that only contained $150,000 for the solid waste characterization and recycling study. I think that's Section 4 of the bill. And Jeff Mock with the Department of Environmental Conservation is here and can speak specifically to the characterization and recycling market study if the committee is interested. I think it's still important that the issue is brought before the legislature. It is one of those pieces that's small and discreet, but until we have a better picture of what it is across the state, particularly in the larger landfills and larger communities, what it is that we're trying to deal with, and whether or not in a recycling effort, whether or not there's a market for any of those products, is something that is too large an item for any small operator in Anchorage or Fairbanks, particularly, or Juneau even, to handle by themselves. It's the kind of thing that if you overlay that across their other costs of doing business, it would never get done. But it's something that needs to be done, and would I think be of great assistance to our landfill operators in trying to market recycled products. So I think it's a legitimate item, needs to be addressed, and the others, as I said, have been taken care of. And the
Representative Boyer, so Section 1, $5,500,000. How much of that was in the budget?
1.5, as you may recall.
Trying to remember here. And the 300,000 in Section 2?
That's internalized in the DEC's base budget. I think if you you need a title change, and the title would literally it would be lines 1 and 2, and would read, an act making a special appropriation to the Department of Environmental Conservation for solid and hazardous waste management programs, semicolon, and providing for an effective date. That would be how your title should read. And then you would delete all sections with the exception of Section 4 and Section 9, which is the effective date. And I think with those changes, you'd have the proper
So you only look at one section.
Representative
Baker. Chairman Mark, I understood that your item in Section 4 has already been done by ALFAR.
Perhaps Jeff Mock with the department could answer that, but I am not aware of that.
Why don't you pull over on the side here? Let's bring the department up at the same time, and we'll see if it has.
I, having served on that board, I understand that they've already identified and have a complete listing of all that.
Jeff, you want to state your name?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Jeff Mock. I'm the chief of the Solid and Hazardous Waste Management Section for the Department of Environmental Conservation. Mr. Chairman, I have not seen any comprehensive study that's been done statewide for the recycling and for the marketing and so forth.
You may want to check with Audrey Lee, the head of that, because I've seen a complete listing. So if we can save $150,000, might be a good idea.
Audrey Lee?
Audrey Lee. She's the head of ALFAR statewide.
Mr. Chairman, We'll certainly do that, and I would hope that we'd go ahead and move this on. If that's the case, we'd end up with essentially a shell in the Finance Committee, so there's no, we can leave it here or move to Finance to deal with it. Either way, we'll get the answer to that question. If it's been done, then clearly we would not move ahead with this, but if it has not been done in a comprehensive fashion, we take a look at that as well.
Yeah, there's been, Mr. Chairman, there's been several reports done by ALFAR, and one of them identifies that because the landfill people specifically wanted that information that's been updated from year to year.
Okay.
So no sense in spending money if it's already done.
Agreed.
We'll check that out. Is that something we can get an answer on this morning?
I will try and get back to you today on it, Mr. Chairman.
Other comments from the committee? Do you have anything else to say, Jeff, on the bills of the
I don't at this point. I could discuss with you further exactly what this was intended, the study was intended to look at, and I could go into that if you'd wish.
Anybody wish? Maybe a moot point anyways. Jim Miller, are you with us?
I'm
Rachel, do you have any?
I was, Mr. Chairman, I was set to testify on Section 6, which has not been moved.
Do you concur with the testimony then that the Section 6 is no longer needed?
Mr. Chairman, I didn't characterize it as no longer needed. I had suggested, I think, that we were going to deal with it as an item in the capital budget. It is a capital appropriation here anyway, and we would just move it to more appropriately to the capital budget.
That would be fine. Thank
you. Well, how about we do this? How about a motion to do a CES, which would be the title change, include only Section 4 and Section 11, pending determination that this is not funded at this time, and if it's not, we'll move the bill, and if it is, we'll terminate the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to be too critical, but I don't think that motion is appropriate, being that there's no quorum of the committee.
Well, we were going to do it as soon as we had one person in the back. Would there be an objection to doing it that way?
There's no objection. It's just to make it legal.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. Okay. Thank you. Good enough?
Yep.
All right. This bill will sit on the side here until we have a form back with us.
I move we put ACR 12 back into the
term. Deal with ACR 12. Dave, write us a report on ECR 12. Stand at ease. May call the committee back to order. It's 9:38. We were discussing House Bill 138, Appropriation Clean Water Fund. Representative Moyer?
Yes, I move that we move House Bill 138 from committee. Our individual recommendation has been asked consent pending receipt of
move to amend as amended.
All
right, there is a motion to move House Bill 138 as amended. The amendment is as follows. The title would be changed to an act making a special appropriation part of environmental conservation for solid and hazardous waste management program providing for effective date, and would include Section 4 and Section 9 only, and that would be pending our outcome with the ALPAR to make sure that this has not been taken care of by them. Representative Gruber.
I have no objection to adopting the CES, but I think that this is a sufficiently important kind of a thing here that I would prefer that we not move the bill itself till we know whether there is any reason to move the bill at all. I have a reason for that suggestion. And we should be able to take that up the first order of business.
So you're recommending we postpone this motion?
We adopt the CS.
Okay.
But the CS doesn't actually have to be prepared. I don't want to put the people to work in preparing us.
Okay.
And that we take this up as the first order of business, or they can prepare.
I have no objection. Can you amend the motion to just adopting the CS?
Sure, I would move that we amend HB 138 as described by the chairman.
Is there objection to that motion? Hearing no objection.
The reason is, and I'll put this on the record so the members know, that sometimes it is helpful if a bill dies, an appropriation bill, to have a blank title in this committee. We may have a need for it at some time in the next 2 years.
We might have something for Rip Sam Miller that we want to put in.
Or any
money for it. All right, hearing no objections, House Bill 138 is amended, and we will develop a CS if necessary. And House Bill 138 will remain on the calendar for Wednesday's meeting. Before we start with Elizabeth.
I've lost all my files.
I don't have my file
can't
on this
find,
bill.
I went and looked over my office. I went up to the lounge and looked in the lost and found. I have no idea where my files
138
are.
138, it was on the agenda for 2 days ago.
No problems, Mike.
For Friday. Let's see if we can. Let's look at yours, the Sitman HCR 12. Just sit with us.
Where's my bill file on the line?
I'm 138.
138 or 167?
Or 167, I'm sorry.
Yeah, where's that bill file?
Okay, the next item on the agenda is HCR 12 by Representative Choquette, relating to Sitman Basin Recreation Management Area and requesting Commissioner Natural Resources to reconsider the portions of the management plan that restrict motorized uses of Lake Creek, Alexander Creek, Proto Creek, Deska, Moose Creek, Deska, and Tala. Tala Latina. Nope. Tala Chulitna.
Tala Chulitna, Mr. Chairman.
Tala Chulitna, thank you.
That's easy for you to say.
Representative Choquette, this bill was, this resolution was put in subcommittee of Representative Choquette and Representative Baker. Representative Choquette, do we have our 10-page briefing on the, on your subcommittee?
I think it is 10 pages, Mr. Chairman. The rest of them have all gotten a copy except you.
I don't think that.
I gave you guys copies yesterday, or Friday.
I move we censure the representative for failing to give us long copy.
Yeah, don't be afraid to go ahead. As soon as you get those from the staff, I'm not sure we have
them. Passed them around the table Friday. Max and I made some changes on the letter. And then,
You want to make any comments on
it? No. The,
you had good hearings.
Oh, yes. Yes, we had good hearings. It went, I believe, 65% in favor, 15% with no comment, 5% in favor if we included the Little Sioux Sitman, and then the rest were opposed. I think it was 10% was opposed to changing the management plan, period. The problem with the Little Sioux Sitman was simply that Harold Hines agreed that that river, with its continued use, might very well have reached the necessity point to where some type of situation had to exist that made both boats compatible. And the other rivers, there was no evidence at all that that it was necessary to make those non-motorized. Another portion that we brought up into the they came up in testimony, which I wasn't aware of. I knew that the motorized restrictions also included aircraft, helicopters, and airplanes. But what we hadn't realized is that they weren't even asked to come to the table. The pilots, all the charter outfits in the area. And basically, this bill stops the use of all motorized.
The plan does.
So what we've done is submitted the letter to Harold Hines and copied the governor. Both of them were asking for it the other day. So I think something's in the works from the governor's side, and at this time I would just like to move it out of committee.
Send it under resources,
it
under where the real debate should take place. Representative Greenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wasn't
that wasn't
you,
a dig.
You are a bum.
That wasn't a dig.
Strike that. Danny, strike the word bum.
So the read, you aren't a blank.
Representative Greenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wasn't a member of the subcommittee, but I sat in on a lot of the hearing in Anchorage. And the testimony was as indicated. I understood there were near riots about this at the hearing in the morning. And people almost had to be controlled by the members of the subcommittee. It was that vehement in opposition.
Thank goodness you had Representative Choquette there then.
Yeah. Actually, Representative Carney helped out. He kind of crawled under the table when the people started throwing things.
But the thing that concerns me, Mr. Chairman, and concerned me, and I started out with no preconception in this whatsoever, was the legal question. This concerns me quite a bit. If the members would look at the letter here, there are two statutes that are specifically on point, AS 41.23.420C and AS 41.23.440A1. And these are very explicit. they say the commissioner may regulate boating if necessary under the management plan adopted under Section 440. And the commissioner under 440 shall establish guidelines and restrictions if necessary for an activity, including the boating. And the commission, the commission that was within the department had absolutely no agency finding as to any necessity. They could not cite any necessity for this at all. And I give a lot of deference legally to an administrative determination. This is within their area of expertise. But there's got to be something in the record to support it. Otherwise, the language, if necessary, in two statutes is completely disregarded. And I think from the legislative point of view, agencies should not be encouraged to disregard that clear type of legislative mandate. It doesn't just say if appropriate or if advisable, it says if necessary, not once but twice. And that impelled me to urge that this be amended, the letter be amended, to state that this was the finding of the subcommittee. I did not realize that I wasn't on the subcommittee. I really don't have any say in the matter.
Well, you were on the subcommittee, Rep. Senator.
Okay, well then, as if I am on the subcommittee, then I strongly support that, because I just did not find
the
legal basis.
Your name is in the plan on the subcommittee.
And Mr. Chairman, I would urge and offer that this committee, by motion, making a motion, endorse the letter of the subcommittee. That when we pass the bill out to the Resources Committee, that we also endorse by letter to the commissioner the report of the subcommittee. I feel that strongly. Now, if they can come up with a new report or something and find some necessity, I'd be willing to take a look at it again, but they don't have anything in the record to do this now. It just, in one case, the only thing that they said was one of these rivers, you couldn't get a powerboat up to it physically at the moment. But that's not a reason to restrict it. That just, as a practical matter, mean they won't be there, but that doesn't mean that as a matter of law they should be restricted, because there was no showing of harm for these powerboats at all. And it just, the people desire the, what was the word they used? They desire the experience of a non-motorized cruise on the river. And that's far short of necessity, because by the same token, I'm sure the people who have motorized boats desire the experience of a motorized cruise on the river, or a motorized aircraft trip above the river.
Has this letter gone to
the
commission? Yes, sir. How about something different? How about a letter from this committee to the commissioner as, in essence, an update on this, and also then carry forward to the Resources Committee, to both, stating that our concern that, as you spoke, that the word necessary, if necessary in the law, and that that is our basic concern, is the law really being adhered to, you know, and the intent of the law, if necessary, and ask both to look into that fact, and then, in other words, this is a separate letter, since this has already gone on, and something maybe...
That's what I meant.
Okay.
I meant we would send a separate letter, and I would recommend that it endorse this letter. But saying what you're saying, but it'd have to be a separate letter.
And that could come out of the committee.
We had testimony, Gene, that didn't like the smell of gas fumes. We had testimony that also Representative Grunberg was there when this act was put together, and explicitly remembers that why the necessity was put in there. Didn't you not make a statement like that?
No, I didn't. I said I remembered a floor amendment. I wasn't on the committees that dealt with it. I remember a floor amendment inserting the word snowmobiling. And I did not recall whether there had been an amendment concerning the word boating. And they assured me that there hadn't. But I remember the Hoffman snowmobiling amendment. And Representative Miller was involved in that, too. And I don't remember any. I just don't remember the discussion. The record is speaking.
What's the deadline on this one? Doesn't something have to happen?
Within 100 days of February 1.
It goes into effect unless the legislature disapproves.
We only have about a month, probably 30 days left. Matt, could you help us draft that letter, or maybe
yes. Well, let me make a suggestion. Joan was your staff who was working on this.
No,
one.
Jim.
Jim. Okay. If the staff, Jim could draft it, and I'll look at it and work on it, too.
Okay, and I don't want to get into the details on it from our committee, because we all didn't sit there. But I want to emphasize the if necessary part on the law, on the two statutes. And that way, it feels, to me, it feels like we got good justification for the committee coming out and saying those two, that particular point is a question that really needs to be looked at. Or did this plan possibly go above and beyond what the law, what the intention of the law was? And that way, that may help lend some credence to yours, all right?
And this will be put together for your signature?
Yeah. Is that good with you?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I would suggest that we pass these two out at the same time, so they don't get the resolution.
Yeah, we will. No problem with that.
Okay.
All right, I'll entertain a motion on HCR 12.
Well, Mr. Chairman, let's move them out at the same time. We can do that.
You want to wait another?
I think that we should.
You think we need the letter before?
I think we should do them at the same time. Otherwise, I'll think the letter was an afterthought.
Okay, I want you to have your staff work on that today. Try to get it to Max and me. I'd just like you to keep it somewhat narrowly focused on that big issue, this part, so that I feel like I got good. That's a good argument for us to make as this committee.
And I appreciate, it's kind of unusual that we had this whole thing. I, as a person who was neutral on the thing, very much appreciate your courtesy, Mr. Chairman, in allowing these hearings to take place, because, frankly, they brought something to my attention I wouldn't have noticed.
That
would
be
good,
huh? Yeah. All right, so HCR 12 will appear on the agenda for Wednesday's committee meeting also. The next bill before the committee is House Bill 167, requested by the governor. House Bill 167 proposes new procedures for absentee voting by enabling personal representatives to make only one round trip to pick up a ballot, deliver it to the absentee voter, and return the ballot to election officials. HB 167 would also allow people confined to institutions to vote an absentee ballot by personal representative. I'm going to say that exactly right, but let's see. We have Elizabeth
Ziegler.
You are from the Department of Elections, Division of Elections?
Yes, I'm Deputy Director of the Georgia. And,
go right ahead.
Thank you. Legislation. This legislation has been introduced in the legislature since about 1985. And what we've seen is that the existing process of voting by absentee by personal representative is very cumbersome to the volunteer. And the division believes that these volunteers sometimes, actually the voter themselves, are prevented from voting because the burden on the volunteer is too great. The existing law requires the personal representative to make 5 trips to enable a disabled or confined person to vote. This bill also...
Can you explain that?
Why? Okay.
No, the 5 trips.
The 5 trips?
What are the 5 trips?
Okay. They go to the election office and pick up the application to vote as personal representative. Then they go to the voter, and the voter fills out the application. Then the volunteer goes back to the Division of Elections and gives them the application that is sworn by the potential voter. He goes back with the ballot to the voter, and then he goes back and delivers the ballot to the division.
So,
it's 4.
I got 3.
Oh,
one to go get that. We're talking round.
I'm talking movement.
Okay. Movement. Once there and back.
Right.
There and back.
There and back.
You could say 6 because obviously they're not going to stay there. They got to leave.
Yeah, they've got to leave too.
Okay.
All right. So, but we received letters and complaints by the League of Women Voters that this is just too much of a hassle for these volunteers. So we've had this bill introduced since 1985, and we hope that at some point we'll start moving. Additionally, the bill provides removes provisions prohibiting a candidate from acting as a personal representative, and includes a new provision prohibiting a voter's employer, agent of the employer, or officer or agent of the voter's union from acting as the voter's personal representative. These changes are required by federal law. Federal law also requires that for federal elections, state laws may require medical certification from handicapped voters only in limited circumstances. Under existing law right now, we ask for a letter from a doctor. So this bill removes the current requirement that a voter's application under this section be accompanied by a letter or statement regarding the voter's disability from a physician or two qualified voters.
Mr. Chairman.
Jim Shepkin.
What happened? In 5 years, you've been trying to get this passed. What has been the problems with it?
Good question.
Okay.
Thank you.
Do you want another real person?
I don't know if I want to. Do you want to know the real reason?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, this was my bill. And the problem came up when I was a freshman. And I introduced legislation in 1985, I think, to do this. And one representative was no longer here, just wouldn't hear of it and stop with it for all these years.
What happened in 86?
It was still there.
Mm-hmm. Why didn't Peter like it?
Peter didn't like it because he thought that we'd have criminals voting, basically. Encourage people in jails to vote. And that they, and they, what they, the people would do, said he, was to, you know, gangs influence and stuff would and mafia influence or that kind of influence would make people vote a certain way. I wasn't very persuaded, but it didn't seem like the biggest burning issue of the day, so I didn't.
It almost passed in 1989.
What happened?
The division thought it was rolled into another elections bill. And this was happening the last night of session. And I thought that this bill had been combined. Everybody went home. It wasn't in it.
Well, no, one year, I think that was earlier. One year a bill came over from the Senate, and this bill, we melded it into a Senate bill. I think that was in about 85 or 86.
Oh, okay.
And it was a Bill Ray piece of legislation. And then they passed the House bill, but we didn't get it out of the limbo file. This is one of these little tragedies that sort of wanders around the legislature. Like, oh, we were looking for a home.
Representative Moyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If it's in here already, I apologize for not finding it. Where is institution defined?
Institution is not defined because when you start defining institution, the more limitations you put on it, the more likely you are to start disenfranchising people who are in an institution that is not defined, if I can make that clear. I'm not sure. If you start saying private or public or exempt jails or talking about institutions. There are people in all these different types of institutions that are eligible to vote. So that's why it's not defined.
We looked at this too and found it wasn't defined. An institution in the code is defined in different ways. And I think maybe it's a good idea to have a definition in here what kind of institutions we're talking about.
Just say institutions excluding penal. Colonies.
Representative Miller.
Elizabeth, maybe you can clarify now. Am I right in the assumption that if you're a convicted felon, they usually take away the mm-hmm. right to vote away. So, but if you're confined in a jail and you may be a misdemeanor charge, you still have that right to vote or whatever. Maybe you're in a jail and you're just coming to trial.
Department of Corrections sends that information to us in a list monthly. And also sends us a list when they've been removed, because they can, you know, vote at some point. And it's a regulatory procedure that we've gotten.
Do you note that on, or do you just remove them from the election files, or do you note that convicted felon, and they're still in your computers in some way, shape, or form?
They have a code on their registration information, and it says, it's either like a CF code or an F code in their registration, and their votes do not count if they do vote.
Now, at what point is a convicted felon able to vote again?
At some point. I'm not quite clear unless it's after they've served their time and their probation.
After their probation has expired.
Do they have mm-hmm. to reapply?
They must test it.
They do it through their probation officers, I believe. And then that information comes to us.
But we, Mr. Chairman, in Spinard, from time to time, we do have people falling in this category. I know they don't.
Hard to believe.
The hillside and North Pole.
With that $27 million road that you got, mile of road you got going through your district now, I would think there wouldn't be anyone that would.
Mr. Chairman, the only problem I could see with this piece of legislation, there might be, especially in Spinard, there might be a lot of voting in the cemetery, if that's an institution, as they have the good Chicago tradition.
We don't have any cemeteries in Spinard yet.
Mr. Chairman, I like this bill.
Representative Grunberg?
I don't have a feeling one way or the other about institution. I'm informed our legal counsel, John Gagin, says they do include penal institutions. I don't feel strongly about that. But one thing that Ms. Ziegler said that I don't find in the bill is where it says that a candidate cannot be a personal representative.
I'm sorry, we removed that provision. That's an existing law right now, that a candidate cannot be a personal representative. And that violates federal law, so we removed that.
So under this bill, a candidate will be permitted to be a personal representative?
Yes.
Okay.
That's an existing law right now?
But they cannot. They're prohibited from being a personal.
Then where does this bill remove that? Oh, you just. On this section that says repealed and reenacted, we don't have the sections that are dropped and added. This is, in essence, a whole new section.
Maybe I misunderstood. Federal law prohibits candidates from being personal representatives?
No.
It allows them to be?
Yes.
Okay. Because this bill, it seems to me, allows them to be.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I have an amendment that I'd like to offer.
Well, I have one. Before you do your amendment. You know, I've always thought, excuse me for being new here, Representative Choquette and I are both learning at times.
One more than the other. Meaning me, of course.
I'd like that portion of the record transcribed.
I always thought when we got these bills in front of us, Max, you mean, think about this, and it said it's repealed and reenacted, I always thought they had the old part still always there in brackets. So if it says, if it was going to do that, would just say amended rather than repealed an amendment. So in order to see what we're taking away, obviously we got to go back to 1520-071 and look at it.
Do you want us to have a copy of the original?
You know, that may be something that really in the future we would want to do on all bills so that we can actually see what we're doing. We're not looking at what we're changing here. So we're doing two things and we're only looking at one half of it.
Why don't you make copies for us?
Well, it's going to be copied.
Yeah, if it's amended to read, Section 1 is a good example of an amended to read.
Mm-hmm.
There you see the language set
right,
up. And Section 2 is repealed.
Okay.
Do you want me to talk about that?
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, I have a proposed amendment here that would simply add another section to the bill. What it does is it is another repeal and reenactment. Did anybody else have copies? Mary, do you need a copy? What it does, Mr. Chairman, is it repeals and reenacts a present system of what is called the submarine ballot. The submarine ballot, basically, Ms. Ziegler can correct me if I'm wrong, is people should have copies. Yeah, why don't you hand that out? Ms. Ziegler can explain this also. The submarine ballot is basically a ballot for people who are not going to be able to get a ballot after the results of the primary have been certified. And so what it does is it allows you to simply vote by party. And if you look here at the second page and the third page, you'll see that you can either write in somebody's name or you just vote for Democrat or Republican. The effect of this is very much like a similar effect to a party lever in some states. And we've gotten away from that. We don't have that anywhere else where you don't vote for a candidate, you vote for a party. And that I think that there's a substantial public interest in ensuring that people know who they're voting for. This affects not many people in this day and age. Simply to encourage people simply to vote by party is, I think, not good public policy.
Mr. Chairman?
Thank you. Representative Grunberg, so that the name of the candidate won't be on there?
Right. That's right.
Is just for the general, not a primary.
Yeah. What they get is, because the primary, months in advance, you know everybody who's on the ballot.
Do you think it's safe to assume, Representative Grunberg, that the voter knows whether the person they want to vote for is a Democrat or a Republican?
Oh, they certainly do, because in back of every candidate's name, as you see here, indicates whether they're Democrat or Republican or what they are. Whenever you have anybody's name on the ballot, it always indicates their party affiliation. I was wondering if Mark Daniel could say something.
For the recommending, it's Mark Daniel, staff representative Grunberg. I guess the way it is under federal election law, because you got to go through this, they have to send these things out within 60 days of the election. So that means there's only 14 days in between the primary ballot and the general ballot when they have to send out some form of election ballot. So what they do is they do what you have in front of you. They send out a blank ballot that says you can vote either by party or by candidate. And then if they have time, if they get everything certified in time, they send out a real ballot. But they end up getting a lot of these back. And what our change will do is says that instead of saying you can vote by party, you'll just fill in the name of the candidate. You know what party he belongs to. And then if, you, for example, you make the wrong pick, you pick the candidate that lost the primary, your vote will still count for that individual, but it'll count as a write-in vote for that individual. So you're voting for the person rather than the party, and the policy call is whether you'd rather be, you can't really read into the voter's mind what they would rather do, but the policy call is that we'd rather have them being able to vote for the person of their choice rather than vote along party lines.
Oh, no, I thought
I don't like that.
I thought you were going the opposite. I thought your meaning was the opposite. I thought you were trying to give them the opportunity to vote by party rather than person. That's the way it seemed.
Mr. Chair, this goes back. This piece of legislation that's trying to be amended isn't that old. I think it's 85 or 86.
Right.
And so basically Representative Martin, who worked very diligently in getting this, is because the vast majority of people that's affected by this are military voters. And maybe Elizabeth, could you give us an idea? Well, how many that you received and about how many?
Okay. We received, we sent out 330 submarine ballots for last year's election.
Now, explain submarine, please. That is a
ballot
that does not have the names on it.
Yes.
Well, it is this. It has two parties on it right now and a write-in slot. Next year, we have four parties on it, because now we have four parties qualified to be on the ballot. And
Democrat, Republican, Alaska Independent, and Green.
Green. Okay. And just for background, we have 56% of our voters are registered, 56% are nonpartisan and undecided, and 44% are registered by some party. And the division thinks that we've weighed this and thought that it's better public policy to allow someone the ability to vote for someone who is on the ballot, that has an actual candidate who has made the ballot, even if they vote by just party, than casting their ballot for someone who did not even win the primary. That's where our position comes from. It's a policy call, and we've weighed it on the other side.
So you, Mr. Chairman, so you support the law as currently written?
Yes.
The submarine ballot.
So you do not support the amendment?
Correct.
No, they oppose the amendment.
Now, would you explain to me, here's this
submarine ballot that we have here.
Mm-hmm.
This page right here is what you presently send out, correct? Mm-hmm.
The whole thing, right? The last three.
All right.
They sent out this whole thing.
All right, let's take this first part here, or the second page.
No, I don't. You can have mine.
All right, please, here's what it is.
Let's take the second page where it says A2, U.S. Senator. You see where I'm at?
Yeah.
Yes.
Now, how will this look different if Representative Broomberg's amendment passes?
There would be no parties on the ballot. It would just be person, write-in. Mm-hmm, because we couldn't put candidates on here.
You get a list of all the people that were ran in the primary for U.S. Senate, and then you would write the person you wanted in and check off their name.
Right.
So if I could follow this, Mr. Chairman, let's look at the Alaska governor's race. So you would all be these folks, and somebody as right now could vote Democrat, and it would have counted for Tony in the general. But say he voted for McAlpine. Well, when it comes back, instead of a vote for Tony, it would have been a vote for McAlpine as a write-in.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. So the person has lost his ability, in my opinion, to vote for whoever the Democratic nominee would have been under the amendment that's proposed. It would have been essentially a wasted vote.
Now, if he would have been with this ballot, when this ballot was sent out this year, person would have picked Alaskan Departed Party, and they would have thought he was voting for Jerry Ward and who was it that ran? John Lindau.
Well, this would have hurt.
Isn't that correct?
That's right.
This would have hurt Hickel.
If they knew that. They would.
Why don't we quit sending out the ballots until we know who in the hell's going to be on the ballot and allow those ballots to give more time after the election for them to come back?
It's the Federal Overseas Voting Act that basically is controls how we send out these ballots. It says that you have to send them out 60 days before the general to enable those people to get it back in time. That's why we've done this.
All right, how was it done before this law was written?
I don't know.
Before Martin's amendments ran?
I don't know. Well, I can find out, though.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think Terry could better speak to that, but as I remember, because we did work somewhat on this, that basically it was the ballots as we have them now in the primary, but because of the folks and basically the submarine ballot, because resulted from the submarine service and whatnot. You know, they're underwater for 6 months at a time. Basically, you were disenfranchising a group of voters there. They weren't getting the ballots on time or whatever. They just couldn't vote. So this came up under the federal system, where other states do the same thing, so that those voters can vote. Personally, I think this amendment will just we very well may disenfranchise 336 voters, or whatever the case may be.
Mr. Chairman, I think I read during this law of conflict that they allowed some soldiers over to vote by fax, that this is a way to avoid the problem with ballots. I think California was leading the way in fax voting. I don't know if submarines have fax machines, but I think that's like somebody look into that.
We voted by fax this year. We allowed voting by fax for people over at Desert Storm. But then it was Desert Shield. But the Overseas Voting Act also covers everyone who just lives overseas, too. I mean, technology will catch up with our procedures, but it hasn't happened yet.
So are you saying that by being able to vote by fax, that there'll be less of a need for this because you'll be able to get them the materials, and we will send out less of these submarine ballots?
Mm-hmm.
Representative Greenberg.
Do you need a change in the law to allow voting by fax?
Evidently not, because you already did it.
We already did it.
Well, but nobody challenged.
Nobody challenged it, and I have to look and see how we did it. I think we may have done it by some type of administrative order, or I have to check it. I don't know yet.
The reason is because we just had a bill in the Judiciary Committee to allow the issuance of a search warrant by fax.
Mm-hmm.
And that required that for a different reason, that the judge inserts certain things on a search warrant, and the person on the other end of the line was having to write the same things in. And rather than taking a chance that there'd be a goof up there, we changed the law in the Judiciary Committee, I don't think it's come to the House floor yet, to allow a fax to be used. But if something has to be signed in the presence of a voting official or anything, I frankly think that we should consider the use of this legislation. If you need to have a statutory change to allow fax voting, that we consider using this as a vehicle to allow it. I think that's very good. With respect to the 336 people, Ms. Ziegler, how many of those people voted by the first submarine ballot and didn't send in the second one?
Well, I knew you would ask that. Our program doesn't kick back that information about how many voted in the second.
Because I want the members to understand, these people who are given the submarine ballot, as soon as the results are certified, they're given an accurate ballot.
Right.
And I think that probably a lot of them would have the time to send that accurate ballot back. The only people we're talking about are a small group of people who submerge or do something equally weird between, you know, maybe if they're on in the space shuttle or something, and they're up for a long period of time. The vast majority of these people are able to send back an accurate ballot.
We probably could, although these are secret ballots, and you can't tell me how these people vote, but we could summarize by the counting of these ballots and the way those counts went, that these ballots would go toward more heavily towards one party than another. I don't know what that means to bring up at this point, but it may be advantageous to one party that that this procedure is the way it is right now. Mm-hmm. Representative Bruckman. The record should show that Representative Bruckman joined us about 9:10.
You said that 350 were sent out?
330.
330. How many were returned?
That, I do not know. Actually, let me check my notes for a second to make sure.
And these were all sent to submarines? And this is called the submarine ballot.
Right, it was sent to military and overseas.
Yeah.
We sent out 330. I do not know how many we received back. Something that would give us an indication, but it's not programmed into our system, would be to count the printout that says how many people voted twice, but that would still not give us an indication of which ones were special overseas ballots, because that includes a list of everyone that votes twice. And these people, some of these people then appear on that list because they've sent in both ballots.
I understand that, Mr. Chairman. Who else would vote twice?
There are people that vote twice.
Bernard?
Cruel and uncalled for.
How do you do that?
Yeah, people who vote absentee and then decide to come in and vote in person because they really are here. People who went in one case this year, really want to vote twice. I mean, yes, they go from one precinct to another and vote. And
Maximum.
So usually there's
what?
An explanation for that.
I'm lucky to make one slip hole.
Yes, we catch them on the printout.
You explained that by federal law, these have to be sent out 60 days before the general election.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, you don't know yet who the winners are from the primary.
Right.
But since you allow them to be mailed back more than 60 days, I mean, when's the date you're allowed to mail back the last?
They have to be back by the close of polls.
Oh, you have to receive them back?
No, it's 10 days after. Excuse me. That's 10 days after the...
they have to be postmarked by...
Right.
By
they have to be postmarked by the election and then sent received by 10 days.
Okay. Thank you.
Obviously, the federal government realizes the problem with this procedure. The people are not necessarily getting names of people to vote for. Has this issue been addressed federally?
No.
The problem?
I read the Overseas Voting Act the other day to see if it gave us any guidance on ballots and how to put them together, and there wasn't anything in it. I checked with the AG's office to see if this historically had come up as some kind of problem, and it hadn't.
I was first.
Representative Shulkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I like this bill. I don't like this vehicle concept. I'd hate to see anything, Representative Gruenberg, that would take away from the 5 years that that we've been trying to get this. I face the same thing in one or two of my bills. It's all of a sudden become a tool for other areas, although well-intended.
Do you want to make any specific mention of specific pieces of legislation?
I will.
Representative Moyer. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Different states have different voting times and such. Is there anything instructive from other states how they handle this, implementing the federal voting law?
I did not look that up. I know that we have all the other states' election codes, so I can check into it, or many of the other states' election codes, so I can check into it and see what guidance they provide.
A question on we have division elections, since we have a vehicle. How does this amendment only deals with the general, in essence.
Mm-hmm.
How does, but the bill deals with both.
Mm-hmm.
How does the new Republican Party's rule changes to on closed primary going to affect our ballots, and who gets them?
Well, in the end, people will receive two or more ballots, depending on how many parties decide to close their primaries. Other states do that too. Sometimes in other states, walk into a voting booth, they'll ask you what party you want to vote, or if you, you know, they'll hand you three ballots. To get from where we are right now to there, I don't have any information yet. I'm working on that. The Republican Party has submitted its material to Department of Justice. Everything that affects voting in any way has to be submitted to Department of Justice for pre-clearance. So that's happened this month.
It hasn't gone to you? It gone to you also?
Oh, no, they copied me with everything.
Okay.
But I have to put together the plan. Not just me. The division has to put together the plan. And I'm looking through lots of files of information from last year to see where we are.
At what point will you be ready to report back to this committee on when that, what, how you're going to handle that situation?
You're going to be working over the interim?
We will be.
Good.
You think it's going to take that
I
long?
I think that it's going to take that long. Because I have five files of information that were gathered by the division for the court challenge to the Republican Party rule last year. It has scenarios. This is what we'd do if this would happen. This is what we would do in this situation. But there is no plan. Now, that's what we have to come up with.
In your debate here, and you're looking this over, do you see that the possibility of somebody being able to vote more than one ballot, a possibility?
That is in the Republican rule, that voting in the Republican primary, which would be closed to, well, the Republican primary would be open to Republicans and nonpartisans. Their rule also says that if you vote in the Republican primary, it doesn't prevent you from voting in another primary. It's a primary concept that each one of these party events are separate. And that if another party wants to close their primary, then they can prohibit Republicans or somebody else, some other party, from voting in theirs.
You mean a person could vote in two primaries?
Yes. It's a primary concept. That a primary, when the state puts on a primary,
is there a state law that only allows
Sam Gruenberg.
Is there a state law that only allows a person to vote in one primary?
Not that I'm aware of.
Well, there ought to be.
Representative Choquette.
Yeah, actually, there's going to be a fairly good-sized court case in this, so I wouldn't spend a lot of time talking about it now.
And I disagree with you completely. We need to spend a lot of time with it because this committee needs to come out with legislation that's going to make sure that our next elections happen appropriately or smoothly.
I stand
the law,
chastised.
Yeah.
Sure.
And that's why I say we have a vehicle,
vehicle
Dave, because
vehicles.
We have talked about this privately, and we have already drafted letters, as a matter of fact, to the Lieutenant Governor and to the Attorney General, and asking what statutory changes do they feel are necessary, mm-hmm. how are you going to work with this, how are you going to do the Republican Party's changes. You know, we want to know exactly what's going on so that we can, in some way, shape, or form,
mm-hmm.
Make sure that the next election is going to go off without any hitches.
Okay.
And we're real concerned that it's not. So
mm-hmm.
we would like, and I do not plan on moving this bill until we have something back from you that's going to indicate how you're going to run the next election.
Okay. What I've seen in the file so far, excuse me, is a reactive approach by the division because
mm-hmm.
it was a court case.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing proactive has been put out there. I mean, we've asked now, what would happen if, you know, remember, when this was going on last year, the primary was just a couple months away. So they'd already done a lot of their operations that setting up the primary. So now they were going to have to backtrack. And most of the information was, now how do we fix this right now that we've done this amount of work to meet this end goal? So in order, the opportunity to plan from start to finish hasn't been there. And that's what the division intends to do. I would really be happy to work with you, but I haven't gotten to it yet.
Representative Greenberg.
I would appreciate it if the division could prepare for us an amendment that makes it very simple and a person can only vote in one primary.
Well, I think Representative Greenberg may go even farther than that, but obviously that's one particular part of this that you want to.
Oh, of course. At least, and Mr. Chairman, with all due respect to my friend from the hillside on the right, the male friend from the hillside, I think that this is a good vehicle to use. It's a bill. I don't see anybody having any problem with the core of this legislation. It's a good piece of legislation, and we ought to. And I, frankly, I merely floated my amendment out here. I happen to believe it's a good amendment, but if it's the will of the people around it not to do it, I won't lose any sleep. I think we should look at the various.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Chuka.
With all due respect to my good friend from Spinard, I think the bill is also a good bill. I don't care for his amendment. However, the concept that we've been talking about in the last few minutes surely needs some further review. And in that case, this can become a vehicle if it doesn't lose sight of the picture. I was referring, Max, to some legislation that all of a sudden you've lost the road on. It's not even the same piece of legislation. And then, in fact, it becomes a point of controversy. Right now, as this bill is written and given to this committee, I don't see any controversy. And the reason I bring this up is simply that when these things happen, when we start using vehicles, the bill can very well become a point of controversy, and it's the League of Women Voters and other people that hurt, because that was the intent in this bill, the removal from 6 trips to 2.
Ziegler, let me ask you, since we don't, this committee has oversight over your department, in essence, I mean, bills that are relating to voting come through state affairs.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the division elections is under the Office of Lieutenant Governor. Am I correct so far?
Mm-hmm.
And we do not have confirmation process over anyone in your department. Nobody in division's election is confirmed like we have confirmation process over department administration, Commissioner
mm-hmm.
Keller, et cetera. I would like your department to prepare a briefing for this committee. My understanding is that there's, I believe yourself and a number of you are new political
yes.
appointees. And I think this committee needs to understand where your department is. Do you maybe a little discussion on the new people that are there and their backgrounds and expertise and where they are taking the division of elections and what kind of changes they see. We've had overviews from most places, but we really haven't from division of elections. And I'd like to, if you'd ask your director to prepare some kind of a discussion, if we could have her back here at some point in the near future, but I think it'd be good for all of us to get to know each other.
All right, that would be good. May I read it, what I'm going
sure.
to be looking at? I'll do the briefing paper on the division itself, check out voting by fax, and information on the Republican Party rules. I can give you a copy of the material that was submitted to the Department of Justice.
That would be nice.
We would appreciate that.
And only be able to vote once.
Okay.
And the department itself, the new people in there, do you feel like, obviously there's been some discussion out in the newspapers, and this is sort of political discussion, but the whole department is sort of, at least the top people, have all been changed.
Mm-hmm.
I think we'd like some background on, do we have people in there that have the ability to solve and answer these problems?
Mm-hmm.
I think we don't know, much about you and your director and whatnot. So that's kind of an overview of where, what kind of expertise do we have in there now?
All right.
Representative Moyer.
Have you finished your list of things?
I think so.
There are two others, I think. One was the question I had, how do other states?
Yes.
And I think the other was, Cabina said, how did it used to be before Martin's Amendment?
Right.
Okay.
And also, there was one more, I think.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, didn't we ask a question too on out of the 300 and some ballots, how many were?
How many voted?
How many were returned?
By the additional ballot, and then I'm not sure I can get that because the computer program we have does not get that out. But I will see if it can be.
How do we get the information we get from elections as to whether or not a person voted in the last election? That wouldn't that be a way you can cross reference and check that if the people are overseas, did they vote or not?
I'll check with our programmer.
Thanks.
And see if that can be brought up.
Representative Greenberg?
I would like to do something, Mr. Chairman. Representative Choquette's last comment caused me to rethink my position.
You're getting tolerable, man.
This is a bill that has been around by the League of Women Voters for a long time. It's a nonpartisan bill. There's no objection. It's going to help a number of shut-in people vote. Frankly, my thing has a lot of political ramifications. It'll make the bill very controversial. And all these other things are new things. And I'm not going to offer my amendment on this bill. I will at an appropriate time on something else if it seems to have support. I'm not going to do it on this bill. And I would suggest, since we can introduce a committee bill or whatever we want to do, this is something that I have a vested interest in, since I introduced this many, many years ago, and we've never been able to get it through. And I think it's lousy public policy to try to burden this particular bill with other things. And I would like to make a respectful suggestion, Mr. Chairman, since it's going to take a little time for Ms. Ziegler to do what she has to do and everything, and this is a good piece of legislation the way it is, I would respectfully suggest that we narrow the title very, very specifically to this one particular thing, so that nothing else can be added on it as best we can do it, and that we pass the bill out with a narrow title, and that we deal with the rest of this separately. It's a bill that's been hanging around for at least now 5 years, and it's time to pass it.
Let's take that into consideration. We don't have to do it today.
Okay.
All right.
But I'm not going to offer my amendment on this particular bill at this particular time.
Would you have a possible timeline that might be good for you and or your director to come back with this? Really, like both of you, if it's possible.
We'd be available at your convenience. Just let us know.
Okay. Staff will be in touch with you, and we'll try to set up another time as quickly as we can.
All right. Thanks.
I appreciate you being here. Is there any other questions of Ms. Ziegler? Representative Bruckman.
On this sample ballot that would be sent out, is there any reason why the names of the candidates in the primary couldn't be on the general ballot with just the R and the D box next to their names? In other words, a typical primary ballot sent to these voters?
Well, the reason why
it was separate on
money, actually.
But wouldn't it be cheaper to take the primary ballot and mail that to the submarine? No, it's the same. The same ballot you see in the primary sends the submarine voters. Therefore, you wouldn't have to print separate. It should be cheaper.
Mr. Chairman,
but it would have
the names of the candidates,
but it wouldn't have general special advanced ballot or anything like that on it, and I think that that would be a requirement to inform these two officers. Yes, I would.
If we could send the same ballot, which is the primary ballot to the submarine voters.
Representative Miller.
Well, I think just following up on that case, and I think what we discussed earlier, say they wrote, voted for McAlpine with that ballot, they essentially be a wasted vote because he was not running in the general.
If I may, Mr. Chair, but the memory is fresh in our minds of the candidates' names, and those are typically a majority of write-ins, I think, are perhaps the losers. But what I'm saying is I'd like you to check on it because I think it'd be cheaper.
What about another possible alternative of saying, when these ballots go out, the primary's already been taken, right?
Right.
But their results are not certified.
Right.
You would have preliminary numbers. You could have their names on there and then say, Knowles, preliminary number, McAlpine, preliminary number, and at least people would have an indication who is certainly winning at that point, the primary. They wouldn't be final numbers.
You mean as of election night?
So if somebody is obviously 10,000 votes ahead, they know that that person then is not going to win, and they would have a good indication of who is winning that race.
When these are sent out, are they sent to the individual people, or are they sent to one submarine or one military institution?
They go to individual registered voters.
So they're spread out.
Right, and it's just not military. It could be anyone who's overseas.
Right. But it's typically
majority of military people.
Right. So you don't send it care of one?
No, we cannot. We cannot send a ballot to an open address. Right. It has to be to a certain individual.
So you had 330 envelopes that were mailed separately, not pouched together.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
All right, glad you enjoyed the discussion. Any other comments from the committee?
Can we go now?
Hearing none, we will reschedule House Bill 167 at a future date. The next meeting of the House State Affairs Committee will be Wednesday, April 10th, 1991. At this time, we'll be hearing House Bill 237, relating the leasing of new buildings, House Bill 177, relating procurement code, and other bills carried forward. We're adjourned at 9:42.